Hello and welcome to New Books Network. I am your host in Russian and Eurasian Studies, Philip Falgach. Joining me today is Thane Gustafson, author of Wheel of Fortune, The Battle for Oil and Power in Russia. Dr. Gustafson is a professor of government at Georgetown University. Dr. Gustafson worked as a consultant for energy and power in the Soviet Union. Since the collapse, Dr. Gustafson has focused on Russia's ability to recover its oil industry and its ability to move forward with it. This book is about the key role that oil plays in Russian politics and the Russian economy. And joining us now is Thane Gustafson. Thane, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Philippe. Thanks for having me.
Before we go into talking about your book, Wheel of Fortune, Battle for Oil and Power in Russia, I'd like to learn a little bit more about yourself, how you got into Russian history and how you came to work in Russia for such a long time.
Well, it goes way back. It just goes to show that life is an accident. I was at the University of Illinois. I was a chemistry major, and I was minding my own business, distilling stuff in the lab and so on. But you had to take general education requirements. And so I wandered into a course on modern Russian history. And that just sort of took over my life. And about the same time, my roommate happened to start studying Russian. And so there he was at night studying his Russian. And then during the day, I was learning about all these amazing things that happened under the Soviets. And somehow that seemed more interesting than chemistry. But something remains, because I think my interest in energy comes from the fact that if you are focusing on oil and energy, why, you're doing the science, you're doing the technology, you're doing the economics, you're doing the politics, it all comes together. So that's my story.
And what did you work on when you went to Russia? What was your sort of line of work?
Well, I first went to something called the Soviet Union, and I actually ended up in Kiev. I honestly believe I was only American in Kiev in 1972. So this takes you back a ways. I met the other day the gentleman who is now our ambassador to Moscow, John Taft, but who was for a time our ambassador to Ukraine. And I think I really startled him by saying, you're looking at the very first U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, namely me. So that was Kiev. To cut a long story short, I went from there to Moscow to continue my graduate research. This was for the doctorate, ended up at the Institute of Geography there, and also a crazy place called the Institute of Water Problems, and they were set up to do the designs and concept for this crazy idea to raise the level of the Caspian by diverting Siberian rivers, and also to raise to save the Aral Sea by diverting Siberian rivers from Siberia down into Central Asia. And, it's very much like the stuff that we used to do in the American West, these big water movement projects. Well, that's what the Soviets were into. Gorbachev canceled all that. Then I had to find something else to do.
I was wondering if you could start telling us about the role that oil played in the Soviet Union, and then once the Soviet Union fell apart, how it impacted Russian politics, Russian economy, and maybe the global economy in general.
Well, oil became absolutely critical for the Soviet Union in its last two decades. The Soviets were having more and more difficulty feeding their population. The agriculture system, the collectivized system, was always the weak part of the Soviet planned economy. And in order to make up for food shortages, the Soviets started importing massive quantities of wheat and other grains, also consumer goods. So in order to keep their military industrial system going, why, they didn't have enough left over for consumer goods. So they exported oil and then increasingly gas. And they used that to pay for agricultural imports. And that really allowed the system to keep on going for quite some time. And then disaster struck because in 1986, oil prices collapsed. Oil's a commodity, so it goes up and then it goes down. It goes up again, then it goes down again. And we've been through several cycles of this. But each time, if you're an oil producer, it hits you hard. And particularly since the Soviets were vulnerable, it hit them especially hard. And so in 1986, it was really oil, much as anything, the fall in oil prices that really blew the system apart.
And how did the Soviet Union recover in after 1986? Or if it didn't recover, how did that crisis lead into the beginning of the Yeltsin regime?
Well, the period of low oil prices really lasted into the end of the 90s. The 90s were a period of generally relatively low oil prices. But still, the Russians kept on exporting. Oil production dropped by about half, though. But at the same time, consumption also dropped. So the Russians were able to keep on exporting oil and gas. And it was really those two things that that made the difference. Because when the planned economy fell apart, everything fell apart. There had been no market system, no way of getting goods from you know, no way demand could meet supply. There was no price system at first. You had to invent everything from scratch. And during that very tough decade of the 1990s, why, it was oil and gas that kept them going.
You talk a lot in your book about the fight for control over Russian oil and gas resources after the fall of the Soviet Union. Could you explain this process in the Yeltsin and then the Putin era and how it changes over the course of the 10 years with Putin coming into power?
Well, what happened when the Soviet Union broke up, you could sum up what happened by saying that it was basically a rebellion. It was a rebellion of the Russian Republic against the Soviet Union above it. It was a rebellion of Boris Yeltsin, the head of the Russian Republic, against the head of the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev. But it was also a rebellion of the Russian business elite and the party elite against the system in Moscow. Every man for himself, and I'm going to get my own. That's basically what it came down to. And right in there were the Siberian oil chiefs and the chiefs of the other, what they called production associations in the oil industry, who moved very quickly to capture the oil fields in order to privatize. And that's what happened. The Soviet oil industry was very quickly privatized. And by the time you get down to the beginning of the Putin era, nearly all of Russian oil production has been privatized. So that's where you get these company names that arise out of nowhere, names like Surgut and Lukoil and so on. And that's how it all began.
Well, obviously, if oil production is privatized, then the profit is going into the pockets of a specific few people, and then the resources, the revenues from it, are going where they want it to go. With Putin taking over an economy struggling, what was his remedy to fixing the Russian economy? And obviously, it's tied in with his relationship towards the oil oligarchs.
The Russian government never really got out of the oil business. And so when we say privatization, it was privatization of the upstream and privatization of the refineries. But the Russian government was able to keep control of one absolutely crucial asset, and that was the pipeline. So if you're an oil producer up in Siberia, there's not much you can do with your oil without putting it into a pipeline. And if the government still owns the pipelines and still controls the pipelines, why? They can still levy taxes on you, and they can still levy tariffs. And also, they still controlled more or less the exit ports. Those were privatized, but there was still a customs service. Now, all of this very corrupt, of course. But the government was still able to collect some revenues from the system. And this was true in the gas industry as well. So you might say the 90s are a time of constant contest of pushing between what remains of state power and then this emerging new private sector. But you're right that a lot of that oil revenue now started going into private hands. And Exhibit A here, the most famous example, was the rise of a new company called Yukos. And another thing that was going on in parallel was that the Soviet-era oil generals, as they used to call them, the guys who were in charge of the upstream in Soviet times, in many cases, they got squeezed out by new interests that came along. Local governors, politicians, sometimes gangsters, sometimes, guys off the street, traders who came out of nowhere. But the most famous example was guys from the new privatized Russian banks. And Yukos was taken over by a young go-go banker who had built his fortune building one of the new private banks. And then in 1998, he took over an oil company. And so all of a sudden, Mikhail Khodorkovsky is an oil man.
Once Khodorkovsky takes over, there's a famous fight between him and Putin, right? Khodorkovsky ends up getting imprisoned. Could you talk about what happens between 2000 and 2008, where there's one, a resurgence in oil profits, but also a resurgence in the state control over Russian oil, in terms of taxes, in terms of oil pipes, in terms of actual production?
Well, you're absolutely right, Philip, to begin with what happens with prices and revenues, because at the end of 1999, remember there was something called the Asian flu that broke out in Southeast Asia in 1998 and then spread across the world, and it hit Russia. And once again, the result is a decline, a collapse in oil prices. We go through this every 10 years or so. And oil prices briefly went under $10 a barrel again. And that was, of course, the moment at which Khodorkovsky saw his opportunity and swooped in and took over the oil. Then, luckily for him, beginning of 1999, and it always happens, oil prices bottom out and they start heading up again. Except this time it was a sustained rise in oil prices that went from 99 all the way through until 2008 and led finally to prices well over $100 a barrel. So that's a lot of money coming in. And Yukos in particular rode that wave, but also put in some Western technology and doubled its own production. So if you combine that with the increase in prices, you're talking about a lot of resources to play with. And Khodorkovsky started building a political platform. He had become, by this time, as you can imagine, a true believer in private enterprise. But he actually built a pretty respectable corporation. Russian style, to be sure, but nevertheless efficient. In its way, certainly compared to the Soviet period. So it was quite a pioneer. In any case, though, he was not appreciated by the rest of the oil fraternity, and he was certainly not appreciated by the Kremlin, because it became clear pretty soon that he had political ambitions. And that's what put him on a collision course with the new president elected in 2000, Vladimir Putin.
After this collision course with Khodorkovsky and the rebounding oil prices, Russia obviously is profiting in a big way from the oil industry, but Russia also has to deal with a changing global market, with Saudi Arabia, with the U.S. always bargaining and shifting their power in oil and their influence on the oil industry. So what sort of issues does Russia begin to go through starting in the late 2000s with Putin still at the helm, in effect, maybe, if not officially?
Well, if you look at Russia in perspective, compared to other oil producers, they are low-cost producers, and so they are still able to compete at low oil prices. They take a big hit, but they are still able to compete because a lot of their oil production was developed in Soviet times, and so they've still got a lot that just keeps on going, without having to invest too much from day to day or year to year. But the problem is that's coming to an end. That Soviet legacy, and this is a big point that I make in Wheel of Fortune, that Soviet legacy is gradually running down. And in particular, the core of it, which is in Siberia, that stuff that all those oil generals were fighting over in the late 80s, early 90s, that's starting to run down particularly. That's their cheap oil. That's their low cost oil. That's starting to go into decline. So how are they going to keep on going as an oil producer? Well, they've got to now start investing heavily in the future. But the future is not going to be the conventional oil from West Siberia. So they've got to go basically in three directions. Now, the first is the deep offshore. If you look at the map of Russia, there's that whole north coast on the Arctic Ocean. That is very prospective. Now, no one knows whether that's going to turn out to be oil or gas. And the only way to find out is you got to buy a lottery ticket in the form of many, many billions of dollars of exploration investment using technologies that up until now the Russians don't have, because they never had to play that game. Hence the alliance with ExxonMobil and the alliances with various Western majors that have the experience in Arctic offshore. That's the oil of 2030, 2040, 2050, even in the best case. And as I said, it could turn out to be gas, which would be fine. But if you're looking for real profits, you go for oil. So in the last third of the book, I talk about that dilemma that the Russians are facing. They've got to invest more in order to get tomorrow's oil. But at the same time, they need the revenues from today's oil. So there's a tension in Russian oil policy. How do you square that circle? Well, it turns out that there's a lot of conventional oil left in what they call East Siberia. And it's the geology is different. There's not as much of it. But while you're getting to that deep offshore stuff at the middle of the next century, why, you go out to East Siberia and you start developing that. And that the Russians can do much more on their own. That's sort of your classic Soviet, go out there in the wilderness and cut down all the trees, set up the rigs, and away you go. It's higher cost than the old stuff, but it's there, and you can produce it. The trouble is there's not enough of it. And then lastly, and here's the exciting part, it just broke as I was finishing the book. So I managed to get some of it into the book, but the action has continued. Suddenly, there's this new development that comes completely by surprise from North America, and that's shale oil. Or as the movement continues, now they're starting to broaden that out. They don't call it shale oil so much now. They call it just unconventional oil or tight oil. Now, what that's all about is that you go back to some of the older fields that you've been producing for decades. You use a new combination of technologies, and all of a sudden that unlocks oil in the kinds of rocks that were too dense, too impermeable to produce before. And it's been an explosion. Suddenly the United States is back. That's good news for oil people. That's, of course, bad news for environmentalists, because all of a sudden now we're into an era of much cheaper hydrocarbons. What does that mean for the Russians? Well, they've got to adopt those new technologies to go back into West Siberia, and there'll be a renaissance, West Siberian oil, as they develop these new techniques and adopt these new techniques for unconventional oil. So that's the story going forward. In a decent price environment, the Russians are going to get a new lease on life.
Is this new movement, will it have to be driven through politics, through the Kremlin, or will this take on a more privatized approach, do you think?
Well, oil is always driven through politics, but especially in Russia. And question number one has to do with taxes. I mentioned the government never really lost its grip over the oil industry. They continued to control the pipelines in particular. But especially after the fight between Putin and Khodorkovsky, the Kremlin had made its point, shall we say. And the oil industry now pays its taxes and tries to stay out of trouble. The problem is that the government's collecting too much in taxes. And that was killing incentives to invest, to explore in the next generation of technologies, and to move out into new areas. So the big battle in Russian oil politics for the last several years has been how much do you tax? How much do you How many feathers do you pluck from the golden goose in order to keep the industry going and at the same time support the state? The dilemma is this. The Russian government, over 50% of its revenues come from oil and gas taxes. And so they've got to have that revenue. At the same time, you've got to allow enough to the oil and gas industry to invest in the next generation. So it's this constant battle over how much is enough, how much is too much.
With everything going on today in Ukraine and with oil prices dipping pretty severely in the United States, how is this affecting Russia's development of future oil since its dependence on oil revenues is so high? Could you explain this relationship in any detail?
Well, yes. This, of course, is the big development, and it's something that broke after I had finished the book. No one could anticipate the sequence of events that have led to the sanctions that we've witnessed today. I think even the Europeans and the Americans are astonished at the devastating impact that sanctions are having on the Russian economy. Basically, it goes like this: if you're a bank in London or New York, and you're considering whether to make a loan to a Russian borrower, there will be what they call compliance lawyers advising you on whether this is a good idea or not. And what those compliance lawyers will tell you is, don't mess with the Treasury Department. Don't mess with the European sanctions. The risks are too great, so don't do it. And the result is that capital markets across the entire Western world have slammed shut. And Russians are simply not able to borrow. And this is not just in the companies that have been directly targeted by sanctions, but it's across the board, where Western lenders are basically saying, look, it's too risky. I don't know whether the authorities can come after me or not, so I won't lend. And consequently, the Russians are simply not able to borrow in any sector. So at this moment, the entire credit system has basically been shut down. Now, so far, the oil and gas industry is ironically somewhat less affected than the others because they've got cash flow. But of course, this is where the declining oil prices come in. Let's imagine that in round numbers, the Russians were getting $800 million a day from oil exports in all their forms, crude oil, refined products, and so on. 800 million barrels a day at a price of $100 a barrel. Now, all of a sudden, after oil prices started to decline, mainly since the summer, now the price has dropped by half. And so that $800 million a day becomes $400 million a day. Well, if in addition to that, you're not able to borrow, in fact, if you're already deeply in debt, as Rosneft, the Russian national oil company, is, where does that leave you? And where does that leave your ability to develop the next generation of oil? So that's been the chain of consequences of the face-off in Ukraine.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Before I let you go, though, I would like to ask you if you're working on anything new.
Well, right now I'm very, very focused on Ukraine and on Germany because I think the story is gas. And at this moment, what we're seeing is a break in Russian-German commercial relations and economic relations, again, as a result of what's been happening in Ukraine. At this moment, as you know, because you're covering this, Philippe, the trends in Ukraine are not good. And consequently, the outlook is very worrisome. Well, that's historic, because if there is one relationship that has kept particularly the whole gas relationship going between Russia and Europe, it has been that Russian-German economic tie. And that is now in the process of being broken. If that happens, that's a historic change.
Thanks so much for joining us today on New Books Network, and we'll look forward to interviewing for that book when that comes out as well.
Well, thanks for your interest in Wheel of Fortune. It's been fun writing it, and it's been fun talking about it. Thanks for having me, Philippe.